They had dug in along a riverbank with fortifications and blinds. Then they had taken almost all their soldiers to the enemy side of the river and hidden them well downstream of what would become their encampment. When the Boche and the Zekis arrived, the Scar attacked them from the sides and behind, pinning them against the river. Surprised and unable to manoeuvre quickly enough, trapped with their backs to the river, the alliance was cut to pieces.
"So, something of the same sort here, only using airships?" he asked.
Arjun nodded.
"But I value your opinion, Kaul. So tell me, do you think such a plan will work?"
He felt her eyes on him, studying him, as she thought it over. He did not look away. He knew better than to cede her any ground. If she thought him weak, she would never talk to him as an equal again, and he could not afford to lose that standing. So he sat, staring at her while he took the space and time he needed to make up his mind.
"Maybe," he said finally. "Then I will think on it further. But not today. I need to rest. You should sleep, too. I need my brilliant penetrator to be sharp of mind in the days ahead."
She rose, touched him briefly on the cheek, and walked off. He stared after her, wondering if he was still in her good graces. With Arjun, you could never be sure. It took the last of the survivors the rest of that day and the next to return to the main body of the advance force, even with the help of their recovered transport. The injured were removed from the Aquaswift and taken away for treatment, while the others were given food and drink and told to use the remainder of the day to rest. The advance force had been making good progress coming south toward Paranor, and Arjun immediately announced it would continue south the next morning toward the Myrmidon. But she made no clear verbal indication to Caldre that she had decided what to do then. He had no doubt what it meant should the Federation deem her a threat. He knew enough about Ketavars and the ministers of the Coalition Council to be very sure they would not tolerate a Scar presence in the Forelands unless they could control it. So a Federation command would be sent to intercept them. Thus far they had only engaged a few troll tribes and eliminated the druids. That should please Vars and his ministers. But a rash act on Arjun's part could change everything. His thoughts were interrupted by a familiar voice.
"You've cheated death again," Priultian observed wryly when he heard that the command had been given. "Lucky you!"
His second was a stout, blocky fellow with laughing eyes and a ready smile. His life view was simple, and his needs small. He had found his way to Kaul while both were in training to be penetrators years ago. When Pri had seen he would not be among those chosen, he had come to Kaul and asked to be his second. Kaul had quickly agreed. Priultian was exactly the sort of man he was looking for, solid, loyal, dependable, and willing to do what he was told.
"Lucky enough," he agreed, realizing his second was talking about Paranor. "Things are back to normal here, it seems."
Pri gave him a doubtful look.
"Are they? Paranor gone, its treasures swept away? All those who went into the keep save yourself and five others dead? There's talk, Kaul. There's more than a little dissatisfaction and some real anger."
Caldre made no verbal response, although he gave his second a nod of recognition. He had sensed the mood the moment he had returned, and those left behind had learned what had happened to their fellows. It would be up to Arjun, whom they adored, to find a way to make it right. She did this later in the day, when she called her soldiers together in the twilight hours and explained why their companions had died and what those deaths had accomplished. She promised them that no further sacrifices of this magnitude would be needed now that the druids and Paranor were gone. They would fight again, but never be trapped as they were at Paranor. They would remember the sacrifice of those who had died and honour it with their courage and determination in the days ahead. Victory was almost within their grasp, as the Forelands were rendered helpless without the magic of the druids. One by one, the governments who stood against them would fall, just as the troll tribes and the nations in Eurodia had. Then she went down among them and took their hands in her own, one by one, reassuring and consoling, giving them renewed heart and belief in themselves and in her. It was typical Arjun the Amphir. And because of who she was, the grumbles ceased and talk turned to the victory that waited just ahead. Then, in a heartbeat, everything changed. Later that night, as Arjun and Koldrey were working on the details of their plan for a Federation entrapment on the Myrmidon, one of her senior commanders, Sten Orr, appeared unexpectedly in front of them and stood waiting for an acknowledgement. Arjun nodded a greeting.
"Is there a problem, Commander?"
She was not fond of Sten Orr, although he was efficient and quick to assess an enemy's weakness when they were in the field. But of late he had become a rival for command of the Scar army. She had repeatedly rejected his request to assume command along with his advances as a suitable bedmate. Those alone provided him with sufficient incentive to seek to undermine her.
"There is a message from the king," he said without preamble. "It arrived yesterday, just prior to your return."
He handed it to her.
"I took the liberty of reading it to be certain it was something worth bothering you about."
Arjun stared at him. He was too eager by half, so she took the letter without looking at it.
"And is it worth bothering me at this hour, Commander, since you admit you have already read it?"
Sten Orr shrugged. There was a delight reflected in his features that he did not try to hide.
"That is something you will have to determine for yourself. I leave you to it."
And he turned away dismissively and walked off.
"That was rude,"
Koldrey declared angrily.
"Who does he think he is, to speak to you like that?"
Arjun did not reply, but her mind was racing. Something was very wrong for Sten Orr to treat her so. He was perpetually angry with her, but not usually so deliberately impertinent. For him to act this way, he must have reason to think he could do so with impunity. She unfolded the message and read it through. A chill ran through her. Without looking at Cole, she read it through once more, as much to give her time to compose herself as to make certain of the contents. Then she looked up.
"My father is coming with the rest of the Scar army. A full-fledged invasion force has been assembled. He will depart with his airships and arrive by the time of the next full moon."
"What?"
Cole exclaimed in disbelief.
"Why would he do that when you did not send for him?"
"Why, indeed?"
Cole hesitated.
"He knows about Paranor.
There hasn't been time.
But why would he—"
A shake of her head.
"Sten Orr is responsible for this. He was much too eager to give me the news. He might have sent my father a message earlier suggesting I had overstepped my bounds, or trampled on his authority. Who knows? Such a message might have said anything given who sent it. Sten Orr has always been ambitious, and his ambition might have gotten the better of his common sense."
"You must relieve him of command and have him flogged."
Her lips tightened and a look of determination washed over her perfect features.
"Though it would give me great satisfaction to hang my scheming commander from the nearest tree by his private parts, it would not improve my situation. The damage is done. There is nothing that will help now. The king will come, whether I like it or not. When he confirms that I have lost Paranor and its treasures, he will have all the incentive he needs to take control of the army. He will claim my impending victory over the Four Lands as his own achievement, and my efforts will be erased. My work will have been for nothing."
Her voice was calm and steady, but her heart was dark with anger and disappointment.
"Still, he is not here yet, so perhaps I can outmaneuver him. You must help me."
"Of course,"
Cole agreed at once. Her penetrator understood her well enough. Playing games with Cor Diamphir carried more than a little risk for those involved, as Sten Orr would find out later, but refusing his daughter carried an even greater risk.
"What do you want me to do?"
"We'll send the army to the Myrmidon as planned. Once they arrive, I can put our plan into operation and await the coming of the Federation. In the meantime, you are going to take a small trip. You should be back before any engagement occurs."
"Where am I going?"
he asked. Her smile was cold.
"Into the lion's den."
4. It was silent and disturbingly spectral within the halls and chambers of Paranor. Everything exuded a transparency, vague and poorly defined, almost on the verge of disappearing. The absence of sound only seemed to enhance the feeling that Driska Ark was living a ghost life. This world, this new world into which he had been banished, was a place in which colour was diminished, clarity dimmed, and time suspended. It must be like this in the netherworld, where the shades were consigned, Driska thought. He had spent endless hours exploring a place so familiar to him he barely bothered to consider the paths his footsteps took as he struggled to come to terms with his situation. It was a confusing and disappointing effort that in the end yielded him little. Some things were apparent right away, others took forever to confirm. Others still offered no answers whatsoever, and left him bereft of critical information, and none offered him even a small possibility of finding freedom. First, no other living being was present. Even the dead had vanished, their bodies reduced to ash and bone fragments in the east courtyard. Any birds had long since flown elsewhere, and any mice had gone to ground. Tracing and retracing his footsteps was sufficient to reveal he was entirely alone. Second, there was no way into or out of the keep. He had tried over and over to find one, and failed. He had attempted to open the gates and the smaller service doors set into the outer walls. He had tried to leave, using the underground tunnel through which he had entered. He had attempted to use rope ladders and the foot and handholds built into the walls. But there was an invisible force sealing away the entire keep. It pressed up against the exterior of Paranor at every possible exit point and extended down into the earth. There was no way past it, and all his efforts to break through had been unsuccessful. Use of magic in every form he could think to conjure had failed. Even the talismans and magic housed in the vaults offered no answers. A few, like the Crimson Elfstones, were so powerful and unpredictable, as well as unlikely to be of help in his present situation, that he had left them alone. None of the talismans had provided him with an answer to his problem. He was trapped, and there was no way out while Paranor remained trapped in limbo. Finally, no form of communication with the outside world existed. The scry waters in the cold room could tell him when or where magic had been used in the four lands, but little else. Glizia had left him the scry orb, but given the circumstances surrounding his imprisonment, it seemed unlikely she would respond to any summons he sent her. Besides, no one who might want to help him even knew he was here, save Dar-Lee. And if anything happened to the blade, Driska might remain trapped in Paranor for the rest of his life, whatever sort of life he might have left in this limbo world. He couldn't even be sure of that. There was food and water within the keep, probably enough for a few years if he used it sparingly. After that, he would starve to death. In the meantime, he could not be sure what living in this half-life world was doing to him anyway. Was he aging at the same rate? Was he being affected in ways he couldn't recognize? How much was he changing without even knowing it? If all this weren't enough, there was the complicated question of why he was even still alive. It was hard to fathom. At Clizia's urging, Driska had summoned the keep's guardian from the bowels of the earth, waking it for the express purpose of driving the Scar from Paranor or killing them if they resisted. That it was capable of doing both was incontestable, but whether it could or would differentiate between those it had been woken to dispatch and anyone else it found in the process was unknown. It wouldn't have been so worrying if he were still a druid, but he had resigned from the order, abdicated his position as Ard Rhys, and then been placed in permanent exile by his successor. There was no reason for the spirit creature to spare him. Even Clizia must have felt certain he would be killed, given how she had left him, helpless to defend himself, and entirely at the wraith's mercy. Yet for some reason it had passed him by. It had come down that corridor, leaving only dead men in its wake, and passed right over him, even through him at one point, and left him unharmed. Why had it done that? What sort of distinction had it made between him and the Scar? What had caused it to spare his life? He had never heard of this happening in the entire history of the Druids, all the way back to the time of Gallifile. What had been different this time? Because something must have been. He had mulled it over and still not found an answer that made any sense. The Guardian was gone now, returned to the depths of the Druid's Well, subsumed into its slumber to await a new threat that would require it to come to the keep's defence. It had cleansed its lair of Druid enemies, leaving it otherwise intact, if in limbo, and had disappeared. His survival wasn't a riddle that required an immediate solution, but it was troublesome to ponder. Driska knew he would not be alive without good reason, and he had no idea at this point what that reason was. He sat against a passageway wall, midway between the exit leading to the west gates and the assembly chamber used for convening the entire Druid Order, his knees up and his arms wrapped about them, as he stared into space. If only he had the Black Elfstone. Then he could use it to bring Paranor back into the world of men and make his escape. He could go after Clesia Porse. He could help find a way to deal with the Scar invasion.
"Isn't anyone else here?"
he shouted into the empty silence, frustrated and angry. He listened to the echo of his voice reverberate through the building and slowly die away. He looked up and down the hallway as if someone might unexpectedly appear, as if his words would bring them. Foolishness. There was no one here but him. There would never be anyone here but him, and eventually he wouldn't be here either, not alive and breathing anyway.
"How am I supposed to figure out what to do?"
he muttered into the shadowy void, his voice deliberately emphasizing each word so that it echoed in the silence before fading.
"A little common sense might help."
A thin, wispy voice replied almost immediately. Driska startled. The voice was right next to him. In the wall. He jumped up and faced its stone-and-mortar surface, hardly able to believe what he was hearing. The wall had spoken to him. There was no one there, so what else could it have been? Was the wall alive? Was the keep speaking to him? He dismissed this idea at once. There was no record of the keep ever having spoken to anyone, not in its entire history, not since the day the first stones had been laid to form the foundation and the mortar between them layered with druid magic. He waited a moment.
"Who's there?"
"Your conscience, druid. Your inner Driska arc."
Driska smiled in spite of himself, a wall with a sense of humor.
"I find that hard to believe."
"You need to apply common sense. Remember when you had some? It served you well over the years. I should know. I've been watching you make use of it. You and I are not so different, you know. I was like you once, rash and bold, clinging to my precious principles. Led me to a rather lengthy period of rethinking my life, which in turn led me to end up like you."
Driska thought, "To end up like me? Trapped in Paranor?"
For a second he couldn't think what the voice was talking about. Then he remembered. All those hours spent reading the Druid histories, just ancient legends and useless information from times dead and gone, the other Druids had scoffed. "Nothing there will help you with the present. Studying the world around you is all that matters. There is nothing to be learned by studying what's over and done with. Except that those who failed to pay attention to the past are doomed to repeat it."
"Cogline,"
he said softly.
"Is it really you?"
"Not really. Because I haven't been me for a rather long time. Only a shadow of myself."
A transparent figure detached itself from the wall, oozing through the stone in lines and shadings until at last it was standing before him, an old man so worn and weathered, so wrinkled and gaunt, even in his present ghostly form, that he almost wasn't there at all. What there was of him was stooped and gnarled and skeletally thin, more an approximation than a representation of the man he had been when he was alive. Also Driska assumed, because Cogline had been dead for centuries, gone into the netherworld, another of its shades. No one had seen or heard from him since Walker Bow had used the Black Elf Stone to bring Paranor back the last time it was banished from the Four Lands, before facing the Four Horsemen in a battle that had claimed Cogline's life. Triska now remembered the story of how the old man had been trapped inside the keep after he had sacrificed himself to Rimmer Dahl and the Shadowen in order to save Walker, there to remain until the keep's return. And now, for reasons Triska could only guess at, here he was again, returned in this half-life form.
"I suppose I must look a bit undernourished," the old man observed, glancing down at himself. "But all things are finite, and I probably don't have all that much time left." "Do shades have finite lives once they reach the netherworld?" Triska asked, intrigued. "I thought shades simply lived on in ghost form." "Well, now you've learned something new, haven't you? Think about it. All those shades taking up space. Where do you put them? Eventually some have to give way to allow for new ones. When they do, they simply vanish. Poof! Gone in a moment's time."
"And what happens then?"
Cogline shrugged.
"That's the question, isn't it? I will soon know the answer, but you will have to wait a while. Which brings us to your present situation, and the more pressing question of how long that wait might be."
"Can you help me get out of the keep?" Triska asked.
"Well, shades don't really help anyone, do they? You must know that much from the way living and dead druids must meet at the Hadeshorn to converse. The living always desire answers from the dead, but the dead can't provide them. They can only hint or suggest or riddle. It is the way of things."
"So you can't help me?"
"I didn't say that. I can try to help you, but mostly you are going to have to help yourself."
Driska sighed.
"So far I haven't had much success. I've been trying for days and nothing works. Surely you can tell me something that will put me on the right track."
Cogline shrugged, and when he did so his entire body shivered as if threatening to disappear.
"You might try checking your pockets to see if there isn't something there that would prove useful."
"I already checked my pockets. I did that right away just to see if I still had the Black Elf Stone. I didn't. Clesia Porse took it from me when she left me here to die. All I have is the Scry Orb."
Cogline looked decidedly disappointed.
"You should check again. Maybe you missed something. In our tendency to be certain about what might or might not be true, we sometimes persuade ourselves things are different from reality. I wonder if it could have happened here."
"I don't see how."
Driska was irritated now. All this back-and-forth talk was leading nowhere. He shook his head.
"All right, I'll make another search. But I hope this isn't a game you're playing, because I'm not interested in games."
The shade said nothing. It simply waited, head cocked. There was a curiously intense look on its face, readable within the shimmering of its features. Driska stared at it, momentarily fascinated, and then began rifling through his empty pockets, reaching deep, fumbling around, finding the Scry Orb, and continuing to dig deeper.
"Nothing,"
he muttered, still searching.
"Just a Scry Orb."
"Hmm. Well, then, at least we have eliminated one possibility."
Cogline scratched his ghostly head.
"Perhaps when you have finished rummaging about, you should check the chamber where the talismans curated by the Druid Order are stored."
"So that I can discover it isn't there, either? I know what's in that chamber. I've catalogued it all myself, personally."
"Have you anything better to do with your time?"
"Wasting it like this isn't helping."
"But what if you're not wasting it?"
Triska was about to offer a fresh retort when suddenly he froze. His hand still buried deep inside his pocket. His fingers explored carefully, and a shocked expression crossed his face. Then he slowly withdrew his hand. In his palm lay the Black Elf Stone. Driska stared.
"I don't understand,"
he said quietly, looking up at Cogline.
How did this happen? How could it have happened? It wasn't there earlier. I would swear it wasn't.
He glanced down, frowning.
This is your doing, isn't it?
There is so much to explain, the shade replied. There are answers to be had to all your questions, Driska Ark, although not all of them might be ones you will be happy to discover.
I'll take my chances, Driska replied.
As maddening as Cogline was, he was clearly the only one who knew the story behind what had happened to the Elfstone.
Tell me what you know.
I was about to do so. Let's begin with my recent past. I have been living in Paranor since before you became Ardris. I was always fond of it there. Spent considerable time in it back when Walker Bo was struggling to accept his destiny. The Netherworld was never for me. So when you left, and Oba Balronen became Ardris, I knew what lay ahead. The current druid order was rotten clear through, made that way by the machinations of Balronen and his associates, and their foolish indifference to the danger they were facing. But while a shade can observe, it can neither change the future nor interfere with the present.
He paused.
Mostly?
Mostly.
The shade made a dismissive gesture.
I was here when the keep fell. I watched them die, all of them, all of the druids trapped inside, save Clizia Pors. But she had betrayed them, and she would betray you as well. While you clearly distrusted her, I knew that alone would not be enough to save you. Your nature was to give the benefit of the doubt, while hers was to take advantage. She would gain your help, then steal the Black Elfstone once you retrieved it and leave you to die. I could not stand by and watch it happen. It would put an end to the Druid Order for good, destroying everything that had been established by Gallifrey all those years ago.
Driska nodded slowly. All those years ago. Thousands of years of druid efforts expended to save the four lands.
So you did something, didn't you? Even though you weren't supposed to be able to do so?
Cogline shrugged.
Shades cannot impact the lives of the living, but they can cause disturbances in other, smaller ways. Lengthy occupation of a place gives a shade a small amount of power over it. I discovered, quite by accident some years back, that my long tenure as a resident of Paranor had given me the ability to change things, now and again, without having to touch them. A sort of teleporting or rearranging, I suppose you would call it.
He looked off into the gloom of the keep, as if remembering.
When I saw you go down, disabled by Clizia's magic, I knew what I had to do. I waited until she had removed the pouch with its elf stone inside, and then I—how shall I put this? I swapped what she had for something else. I waited until she had pocketed the elf stone and was bending over you, and then I swapped the stone for something else. Then I waited.
For me to wake?
The shade managed to look embarrassed.
Not exactly.
What then? Why did you wait to tell me about the Elfstone?
Rather unfortunately, I could not seem to find where I had put it, or caused it to be put. I have trouble remembering things sometimes. The passing of the years does that to you, even if you are a shade. Then this morning I remembered and transferred the stone back into your pocket.
And played games with me.
Driska,
Cogline said, in an admonishing tone.
It's what shades do. You know this, so don't act so surprised. What matters now is you have the key to the door that bars your way back into the four lands. All is well. Except...
Driska felt a sinking feeling in the pit of his stomach.
Except what?
Except for one small complication that will surface sooner or later, so you might as well know about it now. We ought to visit the archives so you can see for yourself. Come along, follow my lead.
He started off at a rapid glide, hovering just off the stone flooring. Reluctantly, Driska followed, trudging after him as they passed down numerous hallways and descended several sets of stairs to the lower levels of the keep. As he walked, Driska kept one hand firmly fastened around the black elf stone and its pouch, where they lay nestled inside his pocket. Shades were mercurial in their behaviour, and there was nothing to say that Cogline might not choose to move the talisman about yet again, perhaps just for sport. When they reached the archival chamber, Driska triggered the locks and listened to them release, one by one. As he stepped inside, Cogline simply passed through the stone, as if to demonstrate how much easier everything was for a shade. The druid ignored him, moving to the centre of the room.
Well?
Cogline shuffled his feet.
Clesia took something else that wasn't hers. From here, in the archives... She did so when you were otherwise occupied. It was a quick and furtive theft. She obviously knew what she was looking for and where to find it. I saw her commit her crime, of course. If I could have, I would have transferred that artifact out of her possession as well, but there are limitations to what we can do as shades, and I did not yet know for sure that she would succeed in her efforts to take the Black Elf Stone from you. So I knew it was better to concentrate on preventing that.
He pointed to a small cubicle set into the wall in a shadowed area, where the light did not quite reach. Driska peered at it and saw that the door was cracked slightly open. He tried to remember what it had contained.
"What was in there?
Have a look," the shade said, interrupting him.
"See if you can remember."
Driska crossed the room, knelt to open the door all the way, and reached inside.
"So she took whatever was in here, did she?"
I can't seem to recall. What was...
He trailed off, a sinking feeling in the pit of his stomach.
No,
he whispered. Cogline nodded slowly, his entire body shimmering with the movement.
I'm afraid so.
5. Before the last stones of Paranor's ancient walls had faded, Clesia Porse was well away from Paranor's graveyard and its few scar survivors, and travelling south toward Varfleet. It wasn't where she wanted to end up, but she had contacts with people who could provide her with the supplies and transportation she needed. After all, she had been forced to abandon most of her possessions in Paranor, leaving with little more than the clothes on her back and a sizable number of credits in her pocket. At present she was travelling with a goods caravan come down out of the villages and farmland west of the Myrmidon, a collection banded together for safety against the raiders that had plagued foot and wagon traffic along the river for years. If she had been thinking more clearly, she would have arranged transport from somewhere closer to the keep, but at the time she had been more focused on her plans for disposing of Driska Ark. Driska, after all, was the sort of man you needed to pay close attention to if you planned to kill him. That she had deceived the former druid so utterly was something of a triumph, and a rigorous test of her acting abilities. She had to be entirely convincing in her insistence that they work together to protect the druid legacy and the keep. She had to pretend she knew nothing of Oberbalronan's increasingly erratic behaviour, or why Ruiz Quince had acted so recklessly when confronting the Scar, when in fact she had been the cause of both. That she had not been instrumental in advocating for the young Scar spy Casson to be allowed into the keep so he could set the stage for its fall, that her intentions for the future of Paranor were in keeping with Driska's own. If he had suspected the truth about any of this, he would have dispatched her so quickly she might not have even seen it coming. Driska was trusting but unforgiving of betrayal. If he hadn't been so passionately committed to saving Paranor and evicting the Scar from her corridors, he might not have been caught off guard so completely. But whatever had undone him, Whatever the nature of his failure to recognize her intentions, whatever blindness he had developed to her larger, more personal goals, it had cost him his life. He might survive the deadly passing of the Guardian through Paranor's halls, although she seriously doubted it, or even linger on a few years afterward, living off supplies that would normally provide for an entire Druid order and would be more than enough to sustain him. But in the end he would succumb. Driska was gone, and he wasn't coming back. Not while she had possession of the only magic that could allow him to escape his prison, which left her free to pursue her own goals without interference.
"Soup, Grandmother?"
A young boy held out a bowl of steaming liquid and a spoon. She took both with a nod and leaned back against the wagon wheel. The traders and their families had been more than kind to her, not even asking who she was or where she had come from. They had picked her up close to Paranor the day before, seeking transport to Varfleet and willing and able to pay for it. She could have gotten where she was going more quickly by air, but she was content to travel slowly and disappear into the populace of the Borderlands while she pondered the path she had set herself upon, one that had begun with the destruction of Paranor and would lead to a rebuilding of the Druid Order in a way that would better suit her own purposes. Her journey was just beginning, and it would be a long one. But even though she was old and her years were numbered, she had the time to do what was needed and the patience to let it all play out properly. Rushing was never a good idea. Rushing caused mistakes, and mistakes could undo you. She sipped her soup and thought briefly of the now-demolished Druid Order, and how things might have gone differently if Driska Ark had stayed on as Ard Rhys. As a leader, he was both capable and wise. But his inability to recognize fault in others was crippling. He wanted to believe the best of people, while she knew well enough that it was the worst that always surfaced sooner or later. She had seen the rise of Oberbalronin coming long before Driska, and realized that if she was to change the direction of the Order, she had to make an unappetizing alliance with him. She hated doing so, hated choosing Balronin over Driska, but the latter simply wasn't strong enough to survive what was coming. From then on, she had manipulated and deceived relentlessly, waiting for her chance to make the changes she had deemed necessary. In the beginning, she had only intended to rid the Order of Balronin and one or two others, but when the Scar had invaded, she seized upon the opportunity they presented and switched from ridding herself of a few druids to ridding herself of the lot. A clean slate was always best, and this next time around she would hand-select the members of the new Druid Order. Her Druid Order, with herself as Ard Rhys. She finished the soup, and when the boy passed by again, she handed him the empty bowl. In 2 more days they would reach Varfleet, and she would find lodgings and begin planning for the future. Alliances must be formed, agreements must be reached, and the groundwork must be laid for what in 5 years would bring about the return of Paranor and the forming of the new Druid Order. The whole process, she suspected, would take at least 5 years. So for now she must bide her time. Although there were a few tasks she must carry out fairly quickly. She knew Driska had taken books of magic from Paranor, books he had compiled on his own, and she wanted them. So first she must go to his cottage in the village of Emberon, which was north of Arbalon, up along the southern boundaries of the Strelheim. That way his knowledge could live on through her. There was also the girl, Tasha, his student. She smiled, thinking of her. That girl was more than some callow acolyte. She possessed serious magic of her own. Glizia had sensed it the moment she had looked into her strange lavender eyes. You didn't get to be as old as she was if you couldn't recognize magic. Tasha Kanin could become a valuable ally if properly persuaded, and there were ways to make that happen. Finally, there was the matter of what to do about the Scar. She couldn't very well ignore them or await the inevitable. She had to make contact with them and persuade them to support her when the time came. The rest of the Forlands might believe the Scar were nothing more than a temporary distraction, but Clesia saw things differently. In her judgment, the Scar were here to stay. So there was much to do, and she must start quickly. The larger plan could wait, but in the end it would only work if she successfully carried out the smaller parts first. She picked herself up, still wrapped in her robes, and went off into the darkness to find a place to sleep. She would have been more comfortable by one of the many fires the traders were gathered around, but she preferred not to get too close to anyone. The less these people knew about her, the better. She would use them to reach Farfleet, then never see them again. They would remember her in a vague sort of way, but never with any real clarity. An old woman, quiet and aloof, her worn face immediately forgettable, she would leave them with no clear impression and disappear into the city to begin her new life. Settling herself against the mossy trunk of an old-growth chestnut, she leaned back contentedly and patted the hard bulk of each of the treasures she hid inside her clothing. When she had taken the black elf stone from Driska Ark, she had barely glanced at it before stuffing it into her robes. There had been no time for that, no time for anything but getting out of Paranor. Since then, she had left it where she'd put it that night, safely hidden away. After all, it would not be of use until the 5 years she had allotted for her plan and Driska's lifetime were up. Nor had she bothered with unwrapping the steel once she had removed it from the archival vaults. It had taken her only moments. Her knowledge of where it was and how its locks could be released was information she had persuaded a foolish Oberbaronin to entrust to her in a moment of weakness. She had coveted the blade since she had known it was there, but had been content to leave it where it was until she knew the keep was going to fall. Yet now, for the first time, she gave in to a sudden urge to look upon both, to revel for just a few moments in what she had accomplished. She reached into her robes and drew out the steel first, keeping her actions furtive and swift. A quick glance around and a scanning of the darkness with her druid senses confirmed she was alone. She placed the blade in her lap, where the moonlight could provide a sufficiently clear look once she had removed its wrappings. Her hands were shaking with excitement as she tore open the layers of leather and soft cloth and found the dagger nestled within. It was a wicked-looking weapon, its ebony handle carved with runes darker still, and its blade matte black, deeply striated, and well over a foot long. She stared at it with keen anticipation of what it might be used for. It was the most dangerous weapon in the world, and now it was hers to do with as she chose. After a few moments more, she slipped the steel back into her clothing and brought out the black elf stone. She could feel the angles and planes of it through the fabric of the pouch in which it was kept. Such a pleasant feeling, she thought, as she caressed it lovingly. Carefully she loosened the drawstrings to the pouch and let the elf stone tumble out into the palm of her hand. And saw at once that it was something else entirely. For a second she was certain she must be mistaken. It was a stone. It had edges and planes. It was the right size. But it was not an elf stone. It wasn't even black. It was just an unremarkable stone. Her rage surfaced in a rush of white-hot heat that left her flushed. She put the rock aside and rummaged through her clothing and pack. Nothing. But she had known that, hadn't she? She had taken what she believed to be the black elf stone and put it right where she could find it when she was ready to take it out, except something had gone wrong. Had Driska somehow scooped up the wrong talisman when he was rummaging through the archives? Had he mistaken this ordinary rock for the black elf stone, snatching it from its concealment and pocketing it without looking while she kept urging him to hurry? Or had she somehow mistaken what she was stealing from him while he lay helpless on the floor of the keep? Everything was suddenly scrambled, all of her plans and schemes and thinking jumbled together in a confusing mix. Everything she had planned would fail if she could not get her hands on the black elf stone. Without Paranor, there could be no reformation of the Druid Order. Without the magic and the talismans contained within, there could be no starting over. Did Driska know she didn't have the elf stone? Did he still have it himself? How could she find out? Without telling him the stone was still inside Paranor. Only if she did so could the stone's magic be used to bring Paranor back into the Four Lands. Her ancient face, deep-etched by age and taut with renewed expectations, assumed an expression of cunning. She had to be careful about what she did next. She had to think of a way to get Driska to reveal what he knew
without his realizing it, or find a way to turn him into her ally, willing or not. She needed leverage for this. But what sort of leverage could she apply that would rid her of Driska and still allow her plans to go forward? At the moment, she had no idea.
"She has the steel!"
Driska shouted it with such fury that it became not a question, but a cry of despair. The extent of his anger was almost beyond measure. The steel was a creation of dark magic with a history that went far back in time. So far back there was no clear record of how the weapon had been forged or who had fashioned it. What was known was that there was nothing it could not cut through, and no one it could not kill. It had surfaced first in the days of Walker Bo and the assassin Pael, while they were on their journey to the ancient stronghold of the Stone King, accompanied by the Highlander Morgan Lee and Quickening, the daughter of the King of the Silver River. Pael had killed the girl using the steel, but had been killed himself later. Afterward, the steel had been locked away in Paranor. Grian Ormsford and then Afanglo Alessadil, both while serving as Ardris, had determined it must never emerge again. Since then, it had remained locked away in the vaults of the Druid Archives. Until now. Until this. Cogline, to his credit, said nothing, letting Driska think it through. For a shade dead more than 1,000 years, he possessed excellent instincts.
"I have to get out of here,"
Driska said finally, staring down at the black elfstone, his gaze fixing on what he believed might still be the answer to his problems.
"I have to use the stone to free myself and go after her."
"Well, perhaps," the other replied.
"Perhaps? You don't think it might be dangerous to let Clesia Porse run around with the most dangerous weapon in the world while she implements her plans for, well, for whatever she's planning?"
"Yes, but what are her plans exactly? I don't know. Do you, Driska? How will she use the steel to advance them? It might behoove you to think this through. And there is yet another matter to consider."
He went silent, his expression enigmatic, as he waited for a response.
"Another matter," the druid repeated.
He shook his head.
"Of course there would be another matter. And you wouldn't be happy if you didn't make me guess what it is, would you?"
"It should be obvious."
"Let's suppose that what is obvious to you, a shade with some insights that the living lack, isn't necessarily obvious to me. Please enlighten me."
Cogline shrugged.
"You have to figure out how to use the Black Elf Stone."
"What? You think it won't respond to me? That I am not a true member of the Druid Order with the power to summon its magic?"
And suddenly it occurred to him that perhaps the stone might not be his to use. He was no longer Ardris. He was not even the last of the druids. That alone might prevent him from employing its magic. What if he had disqualified himself by leaving the Order and abandoning the post of Ardris? Yet he could not imagine that Clesia Porse, complicit in the fall of the keep, would be the only one who could wield it. Cogline was watching him.
"It isn't as simple as it seems,"
he said quietly, his body shimmering as if with a sudden chill.
"It requires something to command such magic. It demands a price."
"What are you talking about? What sort of price?"
"It is not for me to say. It is for you to find out."
"Very profound. Well, then, I will do as you say. I will find out for myself. Care to come watch?"
He started off without waiting to see if the other would follow, stepping from the chamber and closing the doors behind him.
"Let the shade pass through the walls, if he wishes to follow."
Using magic, he reset the locks and resealed the chamber. The Black Elfstone was in his pocket once more as he strode back down Paranor's hallways, heading for the doors leading out to the keep's west gates. His mind was spinning. Had Clesia discovered she did not have the Elfstone? And what were her plans for the steel? He stopped abruptly. He could find all that out easily enough. Both he and Clesia still had their scry orbs. It would be a simple matter for him to contact her. They could speak to each other, and he could ask her what she knew. But to what end? What would this accomplish, and what could he say to her that would matter?
At best, she would be outraged both that she did not have what she needed and that he was still among the living. What sort of bargain could he hope to make with her that would help him but not her? It was likely to be a short conversation. The complexity of the situation was daunting. Neither of them was about to give in to the other. Thinking on it further, he realized that the only advantage he had was that she couldn't be certain whether he still had the Elfstone. She might believe he was ignorant of the fact that it was still there somewhere in Paranor. She couldn't know that Cogline still lived on as a shade within the keep and had purloined the Elfstone from her and given it back to him. She might even think he still believed the Elfstone was in her possession, that she really had stolen it from him. He watched Cogline materialize beside him, bleeding through the passageway stone. He turned away from the shade. There must be a way he could take advantage of this knowledge that he had, and she didn't. But he couldn't think just what it might be. He continued down the hallway, reaching the west doors of the building and stepping out into the open courtyard beyond. The air was grey and misty, the skies a screen of impenetrable gloom through which neither moon nor sun was revealed. The outer walls of the keep were blank screens ahead of him, barely visible through the haze. He already knew that from the top of those walls he could see nothing in any direction. The world of the Four Lands had disappeared, and what had replaced it was a vast emptiness. He walked swiftly toward the gates, noting as he went that nothing seemed to have changed beyond the walls, no sign of life, no birdsong, no wind rattling the tree branches. Nothing. Only an immense void that threatened to crush his spirit. But he would change all that. Standing before the west gates, he brought out the Black Elfstone and held it forth, summoning its magic to dispel the gloom and bring Paranor back into the world of the Four Lands. Nothing happened. He hesitated, not wanting to try again too quickly, afraid he was making a mistake. He walked through the steps he had taken to summon the magic, focusing on the stone, binding to its power, speaking the words of summoning, the congealment of elements surrounding him that would ease the magic's passage. He had done them all, and if he was entitled to use the magic, as he had insisted to Cogline he was, it should have responded. He tried again, taking his time, making sure he did everything correctly, and giving his words and gestures exactly the right amount of time and space.
"Surface!"
he commanded the magic silently. Once again nothing happened.
"Surface!"
he hissed aloud, but the Black Elfstone remained dark. Driska closed his fist on the talisman and stared helplessly at the closed gates and the grey haze that cloaked everything surrounding him.
"It might be that something more is needed,"
Cogline offered unhelpfully.
"Which I must discover for myself."
"Well, you should at least think about what it might be."
"Suppose I simply don't qualify as a wielder of this particular magic?" "I've considered that possibility."
"As you should."
Cogline gave her an appreciative nod.
"However, I don't think that is your problem. You are a former Ardris. You don't always shed that mantle simply because you cease to function in the job. I should know. I was once a druid myself, if you recall my history. The keep responds to truth and belief and commitment, not to a title. Are you Ardris of the Fourth Druid Order or not, Driska Ark?"
He spoke mildly and without hurry, but there was a hint of impatience to his words.
"I don't know," Driska admitted.
"It always helps to know yourself before you try to know others. It helps to know yourself before you attempt to use certain kinds of magic, too."
"Well, maybe I don't know myself sufficiently well to use this particular magic."
Cogline nodded.
"That could well be true. Why don't you let me know when that changes?"
And he turned away, walked into the wall, and disappeared. 6. Far to the southwest of Arbalon, where the Rill Song wound toward the rock spur, Tasha Kanin was nearing Backing Fell and home. She had been travelling for 3 days, passing countless towns and villages, all of which she had avoided, spending her nights in wooded shelters along the river, limiting any chance encounters that might lead to delays. As she journeyed, her night in Wending Way remained a vivid memory, It was there she had encountered the old woman Palindrew, the seer who had foretold her future with such gentle certainty while they sat together in the taproom of an inn. The old woman had read her future by taking hold of her hands, and had given her three promises of what was to be. Three times would she love, and all would be true, but only one would last. Three times would she die, but each time she would come back to life. Three chances would she have to make a change in the lives of others, and one of the three would change the world. The rule of three, Palindrew had told her, a rule so embedded in the fabric of life that it was absolute. Three things could define all aspects of life. Three things could explain all events and all fates. It was true for everyone, and it would be true for Tasha. Yet did any of this really happen? Or had she imagined it all, her mind fogged by weariness and ale, her imagination run wild, even as she sat, wide awake at her table at that inn in Wending Way? Well, perhaps. She had drunk a couple of glasses of ale, but Palindrew, while seeming to drink with her, apparently had not taken a sip. The innkeeper who had served the ale and kept watch from behind the bar had not even seen the old woman. It was all mysterious and uncertain, and Tasha had been left with a memory that was perhaps unreliable. She had mulled it over as she flew on, trying to settle on at least one certainty, however small, that would tip the scales. In the end, she decided it was her instincts that mattered most, her always reliable sense of what was and wasn't real. And her meeting with Palindrew felt decidedly real, so she resolved to stop doubting it and embrace the foretelling she had been given. But as a result, she was saddled with expectations she could not stop thinking about, wondering when each of the three would occur, what they would look like, how she would be affected, and if she would recognize them for what they were. She did not feel fear, not even at the thought of dying three times. She believed that fate was to be taken figuratively rather than literally, and the prophecies felt like metaphors for something more complex than actual occurrences. After all, you couldn't die three times, could you? And change the world by changing someone's life? There were nuances to these fates, she believed, suggestions of things that would happen on a much smaller scale. But whatever the case, the expectations were there, and the future she had been anticipating had suddenly expanded into something more fluid and at the same time settled. So when Backing Fell approached, she put all of it aside and returned to thoughts of her brother. She wondered if her parents had ever brought him home. She wondered if he would be there when she arrived. She believed Tavor would be disappointed and hurt by her prolonged absence, but perhaps grateful, too, that she had returned. But whether he knew where she had been or not, she must find a way to reassure him that it had never been her intention to abandon him. She must explain what she was doing in a way that left him no room to doubt her intentions. She must explain, too, about the path she had taken to find Driska Ark and the work she was now doing as a druid's apprentice. The day of her arrival was sunny and warm, the skies clear and the world bright and shiny, as if newly made and still unspoiled. She crossed from the river into the forests, bypassing her village and flying on to her parents' cottage. When she was still a short distance away, she landed her small craft in a sheltered clearing where it was not likely to be disturbed and secured it. Leaving it behind, she began walking toward her destination. She was already rehearsing the words she would speak to her parents, and to Tavo as well, if he was there, readying her explanations and her excuses, and anticipating what lay ahead. She passed out of the trees onto the pathway that led to her home, searching for what was familiar, and found instead the still-smoking ashes of what was gone forever. Her home was in ruins, a pile of charred rubble and ash burned to the ground, the earth beneath turned blackened and raw. She slowed and then stopped altogether, staring in shock. There was nothing left. Everything was destroyed, everything she had expected to find, everything she remembered from her childhood. She started to call for her mother and father, then stopped. There was no one alive here. No one could have survived such devastation. What had happened? Where were her parents now? Fearfully, She continued to approach the remains, trying to make sense of what she was seeing. It could be that her parents had chosen to find a new home, but why would their old one have burned to the ground? Was it an accident? Or was this, perhaps, why they had left? Deep in her heart, she knew the truth. This was Tavo's doing. Her brother had come home, found them, and punished them for abandoning him in the only way he knew how. She stood where she was, for a time, not 10 feet away, memories flashing through her mind, insistent and vivid pictures of how she had grown up here with Tavo. She remembered playing together when they were young.